Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Last Voyage of the Shenandoah by Dr. Kevin Molloy from Inside History 2016. And it goes like this. When the diary of an American lieutenant, you call him Lieutenant, recently resurfaced in Tennessee, it revealed a little-known Australian link to the Civil War via the final journey of the CSSS, I don't know what CSSS stands for, Shenandoah, S-C-H-E-N-A-N-D-O-H, Shenandoah, it's something I remember. So it's from the State Library of Victoria, this person's looked up. On January 25, 1865, an event unprecedented in the history of Victoria unfolded when the American Confederate ship, Shenandoah, arrived unannounced in Port Phillip Harbour. The CSS, Confederate ship, that's what CSS stands for, Shenandoah, a steam and sail cruiser, operated for the as a Confederate's 8-gun raider and, since leaving port of origin in Liverpool, England, had begun what was to be an eventful voyage circumnavigating the globe in the hunt of Union whaling ships. And I have to say, the Australia was abuzz with American whaling ships. Just like you couldn't move for the number of whaling ships out here. This has all been wiped off. After crossing the Indian Ocean, its destination was the North Pacific, where it was known that the Union whaling fleet was concentrated. In the events that subsequently unfolded, the Shenandoah would be responsible for firing what was to be the last shot of the American Civil War. Further, it would be the centre of an expensive post-Civil War litigation known as the Alabama Claims between America and the British governments for raids on the Union merchant fleet carried out by the Confederate ships, whose port of origin was the United Kingdom. The story, the CSS Shenandoah, has been told in a number of books based on surviving diaries and journals kept by some of the key officers. Yet, history always has a way of turning up new documents when you least expect it, as such as the case in 2015, when a previously unknown journal by one of the officers of the Shenandoah, Lieutenant Dabney Scales, was put up for auction in the United States. Offered by Lieutenant Scales' descendants, its unique and previously unknown journal had been kept within the family for generations and offered a fresh insight into the world of the Shenandoah, particularly the 24 days it spent in Melbourne and the subsequent voyage through the Pacific Ocean to the Arctic Circle and its rounding of Cape Horn and finally surrendering and lowering the Confederate flag in Liverpool in 1865. Purchased by an Australian antiquarian book dealer. The journal, written on the board of the Shenandoah, has been offered to the State Library in Victoria. Until this August, the Library's Foundation and Friends of the Library will be campaigning through the Library's collection appeal to raise funds for the acquisition of the journal. The arrival of the Shenandoah in January 1865 created a storm in Melbourne. The Age reported on January 26th of January, which is Australia Day, when it sighted off the morning of Cape Otway ship. Quote, "Our brilliant visitor was presumed to be a British merchant vessel, and it wasn't until it entered Port Phillip's Head and finally dropped anchor that it was known that she was a war vessel." As the Argus reported the following day, quote, "Remote is our position from the old world contentions. Melbourne yesterday was startled by the telegraphic announcement that the Confederate war steamer had entered the heads, and a report was confirmed by a large steamer with something of a warlike aspect casting anchor. A little before sundown, an easy distance from Sandwich Pier, a stranger proved to be a war steamer, the Shenandoah, and though her demonstrations were of the quietest and the white ensign of St. George's cross appeared, the stars bespoke her position as a Confederate cause." At the end of that quote. Keen to provide full information, the Argus noted the great detail of the ship's complement of 75 crews plus officers, their ranks being listed, the grey and gold uniforms, like the old French military uniforms being noted. The presence of the Union prisoners, including several women who, quote, occupied the best cabins, was also commented upon. James Jay Waddell, a commander allowing all the captives' freedoms to make their way ashore. However, the first act of Captain Waddell upon dropping anchor was to instruct his first lieutenant to proceed ashore and make his way to the viceregal residence in Toorak to seek permission from the governor, Sir Charles Darling, to take on coal and have repairs made to the cruiser's propeller and screw, plus a general repairs to the rest of the ship. After a month at sea, low on general supplies, coal and fresh food, the severely undermanned Shenandoah had been heading for Melbourne for several reasons. Firstly, for repairs and for the necessary rest of its overworked officers and crew. And secondly, to meet the next outward-going mail steamer to convey letters and alert the home government to the Shenandoah's whereabouts after its lengthy period at sea out of communication. As a Confederate raider arriving in a neutral port, the Shenandoah was entitled to 48 hours docking and repairs unless those requirements were more serious and required a lengthy stay. Such was the case of the Shenandoah, which required extensive work in the ship's mechanical components plus caulking and sealing of the hull before it could be taken to waters. The political ramifications surrounding the docking of the ship were numerous. Once the governors had been notified, permission was then necessary from the Victorian government for an extended stay. It involved several cabinet meetings before the issues was resolved. Besides the scenes manoeuvring by the American Union Consul, William Blanchard, to have the ship impounded for piracy, and active attempts to get the crew to desert were just some of the issues involved. It should not be forgotten that Melbourne in 1865 was a thriving cosmopolitan city, with migrants and adventurers arriving almost weekly by basis. It included an American goldfields population of over 5,000. Gold being extracted in large commercial quantities, growth was being supported by a burgeoning farming class, and the city had a thriving financial sector, important trade, and Melbourne was undergoing a major building boom. Lieutenant Scales was a 24-year-old Confederate naval officer when he arrived in Melbourne. A photograph taken at the time in naval dress uniform shows he cut a dashing figure. Temporary engravings published in the Age and Argus highlight the role the officers play in keeping open ship for thousands of tourists who visited on a daily basis. My God, what the heck is going on? Several trains were laid on for these visits to the Sandwich Pier, as well as numerous craft making their way directly to the Shenandoah, visitors being formally welcomed on board by a group of officers in uniform. On one day alone, the Age noted that 7,000 people made a trip to Sandwich, and this is the only portion of the crowd that gathered to view the ship. The Shenandoah was the biggest tourist attraction Melbourne had seen in 1865. Ship's officer was wined and dined in style. For Scales and some of his fellow officers, this included attending a formal dance at a private residence in St. Kilda. He writes succinctly about the ladies he met, the ball in their honour in Ballarat, evenings out, dining at the Café of Paris with friends, followed by billiards and formal dinners, including that hosted by the Melbourne Cup, which outraged the editors of the Melbourne Leader on the 4th of February 1865. Evidence suggests that Dabney Scales was a political journal, prolific journal writer, and certainly an avid reader. His journal consistently reveals Scales had kept journals after his training at the American Navy Academy at Annapolis. You Yanks will probably know where that is. And subsequently after joining the Confederate Navy and being stationed in England and France over 1863-64 while awaiting the naval posting. His later career included time in Mexico, involving in the Spanish-American War, and a career in law in Memphis, Tennessee, before involvement in politics and his election to the Tennessee State Assembly in 1895. Some papers survive from this later period, but not all his journals. At 144 pages and nearly over 40,000 words, his Shenandoah journal makes a fascinating reading. A slightly soiled, buff-coloured, foolscap journal on lined paper in remarkable condition after 150 years and circumnavigation of the gold. The journal begins 1 month after the Shenandoah has departed Melbourne, and in the true writer's fashion, he explains why. 23rd of March, 1865, this is from the journal. At sea, south of Pacific, certain latitude, longitude, my last blank book containing my journal from 1864 to 13th of February 1865 gave out today. And as I had, oh my God, it goes on for a while, No other. Gimbal kindly offered me this one to me, captured with the Yankee's wailing bark, Edwards off Tristan of Canuha, on a day following the last date on the other following page. At present, I am very much behind in my journal, and I am now copying from notes made in Melbourne. The last page of my volume leaves the ship on the patent slip at Williamstown, near Melbourne, Australia. Thus the journal begins, the previous volume not surviving, with Dabney Scales documenting the journal's last 5 days in Melbourne from the 13th of February until the 18th of February 1865. Scales has a sense of humour and titles his new journal, The Confederate States Ships Shenandoah's Cruising for Yankees, echoing the previous log page of the whaling ship Edwards and the passage title, The Log of the Bark Edwards Cruising for Right Whales. Okay, he's whaling for whales. However, it was the seriousness of their position in Melbourne that occupies the first part of the journal, with an attempt by the police and the local militia volunteer courts to seize the ship. The previous day, and while the Shenandoah was in Williamstown slip, the police had refused the boarding rights to search for crewmen assumed to be illegally aboard, and standoff quickly developed. On occasion, Scales wrote comments in French, as he did in relation to a potentially dangerous situation, noting in French that he had seen this individual that wasn't registered crew member. However, in the ensuing debate, the officers and the crew were prepared to defend the status of the Shenandoah as a sovereign Confederate territory, as if they were forced to. Fortunately, events were diplomatically resolved when the officers took it upon themselves to search the ship, escorting off a number of men, including an individual noted by Scales. These were subsequently apprehended in the port authorities. With the conclusion of the work on the 16th of February, Shenandoah was refloated and the coaling began, aided by crews and officer. The Shenandoah departed Melbourne on the 18th of February, heading for the Pacific. The ship's complement had been illegally enhanced by over 40 Melbourne stowaways they had concealed before she left port. And it was sufficient It was a sufficient number of able seamen to enable the Shenandoah to operate effectively on a long voyage ahead. 24th of March, they sighted the New Caledonia, one of their Kanak crew members being able to gather information from the locals in an outrigger drawn by Scales that whaling ships had not been seen in the area. They were also able to get ample supply of fresh fish. On the 1st of April, they reached Pohape Island in Micronesia, Caroline Islands, and they encountered four Union whaling ships, the Pearl from New York, Edward Carey, San Francisco, Hector from New Bedford, and the Harvest, the Union whalers sailing under the Hawaiian flag, which they hadn't actually stolen Hawaii yet, the Yanks, which was the ascent of the locals, were plundered and the crews transferred off. Some prisoners were moved to the Shenandoah, the rest of the vessels destroyed. The burning of one of the vessels is described in a surreal scene with Spice Scales. So this is his notes. Monday, April 3rd, after dinner today, I was sent on board the Harvest with the prize crew of Master's Mate Minor, two men, to take charge until further orders. For my notebook, I take the following. 10 o'clock p.m. I'm now sitting on the booms over the stern of the Harvest, writing by the light of a burning vessel, Pearl, just astern her. Her main and mizzen mast are gone by the board, and the flames have just reached the fore rigging. Now it shoots up in shrouds, upon which the tar has been gradually heated, and the fire crawled forward. The foresail and fore topsail, which are set, are well scorched, and very soon will catch. What a spindle picture I have before me. By the 29th of June, the Shenandoah had reached the Arctic Ocean and the Bering Straits, battling with floating ice and biting cold. On the 2nd of August, the crew learnt that an English ship they had pursued, that the Confederate States no longer existed. The news plunged Scales into near despair and occupied his thoughts and reflections about the future. In hastily convened officers' crew conference that followed, it was decided that the captain to make to the nearest English port for the next 3 months, the Shannon headed towards Liverpool. The final voyage of the CSS Shenandoah was a remarkable feat. Its stopover in Melbourne for repairs and the gaining of additional crew enabled the vessel to continue the raiding missions and delay and lay calm to the firing of the last shot of the American Civil War in pursuit of the Union whaling fleet and its oil, so vital for the industrial state. That technically the continuation of its mission was an act of privacy was legally debated and finally arbitrated through the combined Alabama-Clan settlement at Geneva in Switzerland in 1871. The Shenandoah arrived in Liverpool on the 6th of November 1865, hoisting the Confederate flag as they sailed the Mersey River off Liverpool, then lowering the flag, so performing the last act of the American Civil War. Lieutenant Dabney Sales, reflection on his voice, and many indigenous people he encountered and the events that took place over the 10 months at sea constitute a unique, enduring record of both his and the Shenandoah's time in Melbourne, their voyage through the Pacific, and nautical feat of the circumnavigating the world in a time of war. Thank you very much. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.